Okay, let's get started, everybody. Good evening, everybody. Okay, welcome to a new topic, a new shiur, and it's really great to be here with you. So the topic we're going to be doing was advertised as Poskim. Anyone know? And Pesachim. So why Poskim and Pesachim? Because Rabbi Teresky said, you want to do like from the rabbi's desk, or you want to do something about different Poskim. So I said, what's easier for you? Because he's taking over from me after I leave. He said, definitely the Poskim thing is easier for me. So I said, great, so let's do that. So we're going to do Poskim and Pesachim. What does that mean, Poskim and Pesachim? So let's start with the basics. What are Poskim? Decisors of halacha. Good. So we're going to talk about particular people who are known for their exceptional capability in deciding halacha, and then we're going to talk about psakim. Psakim meaning their halachic rulings, their halachic piskei halacha. So I figured each night we'll just pick a different personality, and we have an hour together. So for the first half hour, I'll tell you about the person, his background, where he comes from, who his influences were, things like that. And then the next half hour, we'll talk about the psakim. So it's going to be very literal. Poskim or psakim. We're trying to split it 50-50. Poskim and then psakim. So let's start with a posek that I would bet most of you never heard of. I'm going to try to do some that you heard of, some that you didn't hear of. How many of you, by show of hands, have heard of? And if you raise your hand to tell me that you've heard of him, I will call on you to ask, what do you know about him? Have heard of Rav Moshe Stern? Oh, yes? What do you know about Rav Moshe Stern? Be'er Moshe, very good. Wow, we have one. So the Be'er Moshe, Shalosh Shuvos Be'er Moshe, this is, what? Not the Chabina Rav. You should have quit while you were ahead. Who was the Chabina Rav, by the way? Okay, maybe we've got to do the Chabina Rav sometime. Chabina Rav was a Goan Adir. He was living there in Israel, after Chabin, obviously. But the Be'er Moshe is not known as the Chabina Rav, but he was known, Hayak, he was known as the Debrecina Rav. Why was he known as the Debrecin Rav? Because he was the Rav of Debrecin. Now, I always assumed that, where's Debrecin? Somewhere in Hungary, I don't know. I always assumed, because he was a Holocaust survivor and he was known as the Debrecin Rav, even though he spent most of his life in Borough Park, and that's where he was a practicing rabbi, I assumed he was known as the Debrecin Rav because he started his rabbinic career before the Holocaust in Debrecin. I was half right. He started his rabbinic career in Debrecin, but not before the Holocaust. He actually moved back to Hungary after the Holocaust and tried to rebuild the Jewish community in Debrecin. That failed miserably because they were still anti-Semitic, and the Hungarian parliament made it pretty much impossible to rebuild the Jewish community at that time there. So he had to leave to go somewhere else. And he ultimately came to America after spending some time in Buenos Aires in Argentina. So I guess a nice vacation spot, but wasn't so great for building a kehila with the Hungarian Misorah. So this is Rav Moshe Stern. So let me tell you a little bit about Rav Moshe Stern. He was born in 1914. He was a major, major follower of the Chassam Sofer. Now, the Chassam Sofer is one of those people, one of those rare people that everybody was a major follower of the Chassam Sofer, but particularly Hungarians. We had in Keli Masvidim just last week, Rabbi Moshe Bamberger came to speak. Rabbi Bamberger is the Mashkiach in Lander College, and he was talking about the Chassam Sofer a little bit, and he said, the Chassam Sofer is one of those rare people that, like, everyone thinks he belongs to them. Like, everyone thinks he's one of the Germans assume that he's a German, meaning the Yekis assume he's like a Yeki, and the Hungarians assume he's a Hungarian, and the Hasidim think he's a Hasid. Like, you know, the Gemara says about Esther Amalka, that everyone, she found Chayn Be'inei, everybody, that everyone thought she was one of them. They say the same thing, by the way, about Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. That Rabbi Teller said, I think, that when Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach passed away, there were so many people that came to the Levaya of all different stripes of Israeli society that someone overheard one person in the Kippah Seruga telling another person in the Kippah Seruga, I don't understand, what are all these Charedim doing here? Like, they isn't he our rabbi? Like, how could it be that he appeals to all these Charedim? But he appealed to everybody. So the Chassam Sofer was one of those kinds of people. Debrecin Rav was not one of those kinds of people, as we'll soon see, but the Chassam Sofer Sofer was certainly one of those kinds of people. And the Chassam, even though he was a big, big Kana'i, the Chassam Sofer, he fought very, very hard against the Reform. So the Debre Tzinah Rav was a huge follower of the Chassam Sofer. He obviously never met him because he was only born in 1914, and the Chassam Sofer died way, way before that. The Debre Tzinah Rav Moshe Stern had four brothers prior to the Holocaust, and they were all known in their community as the Iluyasha Stern boys, meaning the last name was Stern, so they were known as the Iluyasha Stern boys. They were all known as Iluyim. They were all known as geniuses. One of them survived the Holocaust. The one that survived the Holocaust was named Rav Betzal Stern. He wrote a sefer called Betzel HaChachma, which is also a Shalos Tshuva sefer. So the two out of the five survived. They both wrote many, many volumes of Shalos and Tshuvas and were major poskim and leaders in the later part of the 20th century in Orthodox Judaism. So it really just like drives home the point of just like how much was lost in the Holocaust. Because the other three brothers weren't known to be lesser than the two that survived. Adrabba, they were all Iluyim. They were all around the same Madrega. And the two that survived both became these Gedolei Hador, these huge poskim for Klal Yisrael. So it's really a little frightening when you think about that, you know, about what was lost in the Holocaust. Sometimes you have these, you know, obviously Torah is not a Yerusha that necessarily, if your father's a rabbi, that you're going to be a rabbi. If your father's a gadol, that you're going to be a gadol. It doesn't work that way. Person has to work hard to learn Torah. Marein Rav Shechter Shlita often tells the story about when he met the stipler. There are a lot of fake stories about what happened when he met the stipler, but the real story is that part of the real story, at least, is that he asked the stipler. The stipler, of course, was Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, the father of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, but he used to be known as Rav Chaim was the son of the stipler. The stipler was the stipler svarim are used in every yeshiva in the world, pretty much. The Kilos Yaakov van Shas is a major, major sefer. So when Rav Shechter met the stipler, he asked him for a bracha that they should be zochet to have children. And he gave him a bracha, then he asked for a bracha for success in learning Torah. And the stipler said, no. You don't give brachas for success in learning Torah because there's a success in learning Torah depends on your effort and your effort alone. That's the only way to be successful in learning Torah. There's no magic in success in learning Torah. So while we do believe that, there are certain families that seem a little more mesugal, that seem a little more capable of producing enormous Talmidei Chachamim. For example, Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss is one of, I think, six or seven Weiss boys. All of them are Av Beis Dins and Rabbanim of cities and Poskim, and you only know about Rav Asher Weiss because he speaks English really, really well, and he speaks very nicely in a modern way, and he writes beautiful tshuvas. His brothers are all Gaonim Adirim. He has a brother of Binyamin Weiss who's the Rav of Montreal, and he has the brother in Union City and brother everywhere. They're all Gedolei Torah. Agav, I'm getting way off the Debre Tzinah over here, but you know the Maisa about how Rav Asher Weiss's brothers all came to be, how they came to be. Great Maisa. Maybe we'll talk about the Kleisenberger Rebbe one time, but Rav Asher Weiss's Rebbe was a Kleisenberger Rebbe. Kleisenberger Rebbe was an unbelievable person. Again, worth a night shear on the Kleisenberger Rebbe. Maybe we'll get there. But Rav Asher Weiss, when he was... Rav Asher Weiss's father was a close Talmud of the Kleisenberger Rebbe. And Rav Asher Weiss's father met the Kleisenberger Rebbe in the concentration camps. And they were sitting lying on one of those wooden planks in the concentration camp, and his father like negotiated with someone to be able to get next to the Kleisenberger Rebbe, and he started talking to him and learning, and he started asking him and learning, and the Kleisenberger Rebbe said, Bacharul, what are you doing talking? Look where we are. What are we going to talk about? So he said, So Rav Asher Weiss's father said, how could we not talk and learning in a place like this, in a situation like this? And Kleisenberger Rebbe was very taken and very impressed by Rav Asher Weiss's father. They spent essentially the rest of the Holocaust together, talking and learning whenever they could, and developing a close relationship. And then after the Holocaust, somehow they found themselves in a situation where there were a lot of Jewish bodies that needed kvura, and they took it upon themselves to bury by hand, just, you know, dig holes and bury these bodies, meis mitzvah. They were all meis mitzvah. and they were malnourished. They didn't have kochos. If you've ever been to a funeral and you had to fill in the grave at the end, if you have five able-bodied, well-nourished men, it's still difficult. It's still hard to do. And here are these two malnourished people trying to dig the graves, not just fill in the graves, multiple graves. It was not at all easy. And at some point, Rav Asher Weiss's father said, I give up. I just can't do it anymore. So the Kleisenberg Rebbe turned to him and said, what bracha can I give you that would make you want to go on and make you continue? So he said, if you give me a bracha that my children will light up the world with their Torah, then I'll continue. So the Kleisenberg Rebbe gave him such a bracha, and he was zochet, I don't know how many it is, 6, 7 sons, all of them, huge talmidei chachamim. Again, you know Rav Asher Weiss, so like the way a chassid learns that story is, wow, look at the power of the bracha of a Rebbe, right? The way Litvak learns that story is, a kind of person that if he had to ask for one bracha would be to raise children that are going to light up the world with their Torah. That's the kind of person who's going to raise children that would light up the world with their Torah. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chayim. I think they're both true. And that was the story of Rosh Weiss. But anyway, back to the Debrei Tzvi Rav. So he survived the Holocaust. His Rebbeim were not people you've heard of. They were real old Hungarian Talmidei Chacham. His father was Rav Avram Stern, was the Dayan in the town bordering Hungary where he grew up. His grandfather was Rav Yosef Meir Tigerman, who was the Neuhausler Rav, also from around that area. They were both killed in Auschwitz. And as a yeshiva boy, they say, the legend had it, when Rav Moshe Stern was learning in yeshiva, he would wake up at 3 a.m., to start learning every day. I don't know when he went to sleep, but let's assume 11. I don't know. He did not sleep very much, which, by the way, is not something necessarily to emulate. If you need your sleep, get your sleep. It's a good idea to be well-rested. Who tells us it's a good idea to be well-rested and sleep a lot? Sleep as much as you need? The Rambam, right? So the Rambam knew how to learn. So it's a good idea to be well-rested. But every once in a while, you have people who are able to function on less sleep, that are able to... I'm not one of those people, but there are people that are able to function on less sleep. So the Debrei Tzvi Rav, when he was a bachur, the guys in yeshiva said they would remember he'd wake up at 3 a.m. for his first chavrusa of the day. But he asked his chavrusa to wake him up, and every time his chavrusa came to wake him up, he woke up his roommate. So they came up with a system where, this sounds crazy, they tied a rope around his leg and had the rope hanging out the window, and when his chavrusa would come by, he'd yank on the rope and it would pull on his leg, and that's how he would wake up for his 3 a.m. chavrusa. I don't know, an alarm clock seems simpler, but that's what they had at that time. Rav Moshe Stern married the granddaughter of the Rav of Debrecen, of the Debrecen Rav. So the real Debrecen Rav was his grandfather-in-law. His grandfather-in-law actually survived the Holocaust, but didn't move back to Debrecen. So because he didn't move back to Debrecen, Rav Moshe Stern moved back to Debrecen to try to restart the Jewish community. Again, it didn't help. Now, throughout the war, though, he had when the Nazis invaded Hungary in 1944, he was a Dayan. He was already a Chashma rabbi, and he was dealing with the most dreadful shilas you could imagine. He never published them. He never published his shilas that he was dealing with at that time. There are others that publish shilas that happened around that time in different places. Most famously, anyone know? Tshuvas Mimamakim, right? Rav Ephraim Ashri wrote Tshuvas Mimamakim, which were all the shilas that he was asked about, you know, with people dealing with the most horrific, horrific conditions. It's a historical document. I remember when Rav Schachter was working on the Corona Tshuvas, so we were working on it with him and a group of us, and we realized as we were working on these tshuvas with him that this is going to be history. I mean, this is going to be a historical document. It's not that these things come up all the time. It's that when people want to learn about what Jews went through at different times, you can learn the tshuvas mimamakim to learn about what Jews were going through in the ghettos and in the Holocaust. And obviously on a very, very different level, but the Corona Tshuvas also, you can learn Rav Asher Weiss's Corona Tshuvas, Rav Schachter's Corona Tshuvas. They're going to be learned for decades and maybe more, where people are going to see what was going on in the world at that time. Debrecen Rav had that. but he had all these shailas and he never published the tshuvas in them. It could be that it was too painful for him. A lot of Holocaust survivors, it was just too painful for them to really talk about. In fact, the Debre Tzina Rav never really recorded his whole story of what happened in the Holocaust. He writes in the introduction to the seventh chelek of Be'er Moshe. In total, there are eight chalakim of Be'er Moshe. There are eight volumes of Be'er Moshe. It's published in four volumes and two volumes in each one. Yeah, they're big, fat volumes. So there are eight chalakim of Be'er Moshe. He writes an akdama to the seventh chelek that he's preparing a whole essay that describes everything he went through in the Holocaust, that's going to tell the whole story, and he's going to publish that in the ninth volume of Be'er Moshe. But the ninth volume never came to be. It was already too late. It was already, too old to be able to produce it. And therefore, we never got to see. The world never got to see. By the time he was ready to talk about it, by the time he was ready to share it, the world wasn't able to see it anymore. He was no longer able to produce it, which is also Musar Haskell about, having access to people. You know, there are still Holocaust survivors around today that are still able to talk and to be able to have any access to them, to realize that they're not here forever, and what they have to share is not necessarily here forever. Anyway, during the war years, the Hungarian fascists helped the Nazis round up Jews from his village, and they transported them to Debrecen, actually. And at that time, he met a Talmud Chacham who had a Gemara Tainis and a Sefer Gvuras Ari. What's the Sefer? Who wrote the Sefer Gvuras Ari? The author of the Shagas Aryeh, right? The Gvuras Aryeh is an ingenious work. Now, Maseches Tainis is one of those Maseches. By show of hands, how many have ever learned Maseches Tainis? Right. But how many, by show of hands, have ever learned Maseches Vachim? Right. You see, meaning Maseches Tainis is one of those Maseches. It's not like you learn what you learn for your bar mitzvah. You learn for your bar mitzvah. How many learned for your bar mitzvah? Okay, a couple, right? You learn Vibra Mitzvah, you learn Bikiyas Seder in high school, right? Meaning, because it's got a lot of good stories, right? That's when you learn Maseches Tainis. The Debre Tzina Rav saw Maseches Tainis with a commentary of the Gvuras Ari, and he said, what? The Shagas Aryeh wrote a commentary on Maseches Tainis? The Shagas Aryeh was a super duper genius. I would think he would only write on like the most difficult Maseches. He was stunned by that. And then he opened up a Gvuras Ari, and he couldn't believe the depth of it. Shagas Aryeh was a world's genius. With the Shagas, I always say that if you learn the Shagas Aryeh, it's different than other Achronim. When you learn most Achronim, they say, here's what Rashi says, here's what Tosa says, these are the Kashas and Rashi, here's how to answer them, these are the Kashas and Tosos, here's how to answer them. Sometimes a really brisker Achron will be able to tell you, well, they're both right, and this one is looking at it from this point of view, and that one is looking at it from that point of view, right? That's Brisker Torah. Brisker Torah is known as Torah of Tzvei Dinim, but it's not really about Tzvei Dinim. It's about, as Rav Meir Tversky Shlita once said, the Chiddush that Reb Chaim had in learning was that the Rambam and the Ravid both knew how to learn. Meaning, up until then, the point was to say, oh, there's a Machlokas Rishonim, so who's right? And trying to figure out who's right. So that one's right and that one's wrong, because I have 10 rayas that this one is right. What Reb Chaim introduced to learning was that the Rambam knew how to learn and the Ravid knew how to learn, that they were both right, that they both, but they were looking at it from different perspectives. So they're Tzvei Dinim, and this one emphasizes this din, and this one emphasizes that din, and that's why they're both able to, but that is not how the Shagas Aryeh worked. The way the Shagas Aryeh worked was, here's what Rashi says, here's why he's wrong. Here's what Tosa says. Here's why he's wrong. And here's what I say. Meaning he was an Achron who was not afraid to argue on Rishonim, but an absolute genius. So the Debre Tzina Rav was astounded by the genius of the Gvuras Aryeh. And when he was forced to leave during the Holocaust, he was rounded up. He was up to Daf Yud Ches. And he took that as a siman min haShemayim that he was going to live. Yud Ches, of course, Chai. So he took that as a siman haShemayim that he was destined to survive. That this is, a very Hungarian type of... anyone of Hungarian descent over here? I am. Right? So like you have maybe you're a generation removed from this, but if you have bubbies or great-grandma that are like are very machmid to like, with the red bendels and with, I'm saying, like ayin hara, and they do poo-poo-poo, and like they're like very superstitious about things. This is like a Hungarian thing. In fact, the red bendels, about wearing red things, they sell you at like Kever Rachel for like $10 or something. Right, so there's a Tosefta Masechta Shabbos that says that it's Darkei HaMori, that it's Aser, that it's Nisa Daraisa to wear a red string to try to warn it. It's a Beferish Tosefta. So the Debre Tzina Rav has a tshuva about it, where someone asked him, isn't it an Iser to wear a red bandle? He said, I know that there's a Tosefta in Shabbos that says that, but my Bubby wore it. My Bubby insisted that we wear it, so it must be that it's okay. I mean, that's, you know, I'm trying to give you a picture of like what it means to grow up in this Hungarian kind of context. So he took that as a simon. He got up to Daf Yud Ches, and then they were thrown out. He took that as a simon chai, that he's going to live. And he had to leave his farm behind. So he left his Gemara Tainus and his Gvuras Ari on the table when he was rounded up by the Nazis. In the camps, when he was in the concentration camps, he took a neder that if he survives, he's going to reprint the Gvuras Ari with a nicer printing and his own Ha'aros, his own Chidushim, on the Gvuras Ari, which he did. He survived and he reprinted the Gvuras Ari on Tainus with his Ha'aros on it. Amazingly, somehow, someone had gotten to his apartment and boxed up all the Sfarim and hid them. And after the war, he was able to retrieve his Sfarim. And when he opened up the first box of Sfarim, the very top sefer on the box was the Gvuras Ari HaMaseches Tainus. And again, he took all of this as Simen Min HaShemayim. Everything was a Simen Min HaShemayim of what he was supposed to do and what direction he was supposed to take. So ultimately, he ends up in America, and he was in Borough Park, and he stayed in Borough Park even during the summertime. Why is that a Chiddush? Anyone here ever been to Woodridge or Woodburn or the right? That's where Borough Park is. You go to Bai Night on Erev Shabbos, right? And you get all the Heimish food because Borough Park is closed in the summertime. There's no one there. Everyone's at the bungalow. No one's. But the Debre Tzina Rav felt that if there are no rabbanim in Brooklyn, he's got to stay because whoever's staying needs a rabbi. So he felt that it was his achrayus to stay and not to go away for the summer. You know, in Camp Cayley with the Masmidim, we go visit Talmidei Chachamim because they're all there. They're all up in the mountains for the summer. There are so many enormous Talmidei Chachamim. Just last week, we visited Rabbi Saul Reisman and Rav David Cohn, who are two Gaonim Gedolim, but they're around the mountains for the summer because that's where people go. Debre Tzina Rav felt that it was his obligation to stay. He wore Chassidus Shel Levush on Shabbos. But he was not a chassid. He was Hungarian, but he was not a chassid. But he would encourage people toward chassidus because he thought that that was the best way to maintain Yiddishkeit. He was very, very, very strongly opposed to modernity in almost all forms. Like he was not a huge fan of Yeshiva University. And I'm not guessing when I say that. He has a tshuva about it. He has a tshuva where it seems from the shaila. And this is why it's important to realize that there's such a thing called a kanai in this world. There are people who are big kanaim. It's not bad. It's okay that there are kanaim. I think it's a good checks and balances system in Klal Yisrael. I don't think you should be a kanai, but it's good for the Jewish people that there are some people that are kanaim. Debre Tzina Rav definitely fits that category. He has a tshuva where, and don't judge him by this tshuva, he's coming from a different place than you're coming from. But again, just to try to give you the picture of who he was, what his personality was, he has a tshuva which seems to be, the shaila was whether you're allowed to learn Rav Soloveitchik Sfarim. It seems to be that was the shaila, just based on the tshuva. He doesn't name names, but I'll read you what he writes. He says, Ola Mashal, Misha Yilmod, Misefer Shemechabro Rush Yeshiva, Be'eze Yeshivas University. He said, it could be that you'll find a book that's written by someone who is a Rosh Yeshiva in, I don't know, some sort of, let's call it Yeshiva University. Which, obviously, there is a Yeshiva University. I mean, he says, V'yera rov b'kiyusa b'torah. And you're going to see the person is an unbelievable Torah genius. Chas v'sholom yomer b'vadei shari lios mimechanecha Yeshiva University. Then you're going to get the impression, because the author is such a Torah genius, that you're allowed to attend Yeshiva University, right? He says, "Vishari lilmot sham," that you could learn there. Me'achar sharav gadol b'Torah kavosa omei barosh. After there's such a Torah giant, that's the Rosh Yeshiva. Shebe'emes pigul u'metuavu lanu kayadua meforsam. This is pigul. This is disgusting. Everyone knows that. Hachada. That's first of all. Va'od. And second of all, He could hide in there and sneak in there all these sorts of terrible krum hashkafos that you could that you don't even realize you're imbibing as you read through these svarim. You're going to be reading, you know, the Sefer Eretz Hatzvi, and you're going to say, "Wow, this is genius!" And then you're going to pick up a big fatzon and you're going to start reading Zionism. This is going to be, you know, it could be terrible. You can pick up all these horrible, horrible things. V'isur gomer hu lilmod misifreyem. That's a kanoi, right? Meaning, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, you could say that. He has, in fact, he has similar things to say about Zionists. Explicitly, he says, "V'kan ani machriz modia shibnimsa b'sifri be'izu mekoman. If you find anywhere in my books," says the Debre Tzidur Rav, "she'skarti dvar shmua mishmei tshuva o chidushim shalnisham chabru humei elu oyotzei dofen. If you find any quotes from any rabbanim who are Zionists, you should know, Tos Ubiyadi, I'm mistaken. V'leyadati shumehem, I must have not known that the author was a Zionist. U'me'amonam v'ashem yisach li'al shigagasi. And God should forgive me for such things." So he's pretty strong. He has a tshuva that you shouldn't follow OU kashrus because the rabbis wear short jackets and have kol mine magazinim b'toch beisam. And he thought that they whatever. So again, a real kanoi. So his style, though, is a beautiful style of writing. He writes in a very easy to read kind of style, unlike the Minchas Yitzchak, who is the gaivin of the Eid HaRedis, who is not as much of a kanai, but, you know, is the gaivin of the Eid HaRedis. Minchas Yitzchak wrote his tshuvas to be, and they were meant to be difficult to read. He was writing for an elite group of people, and he didn't want it to be understood by the Hamonam. Debre Tzina Rav wrote in a way that he wanted everybody to be able to understand it. He would start with Nishalti, I was asked this, short answer, this is what I told them, and here's my hesber. And he'd go through paragraphs, he'd number the paragraphs, and then at the end of every tshuva, he'd have what he calls Peros Hanoshrim, that which emerges from this tshuva, where he summarizes all the points that he made in this tshuva. Very, very, very beautiful, beautifully written tshuvas. In his introduction, you learn a lot about Sfarim by just reading what the author tells you about the Sefer. It's very worthwhile to read introductions to Sfarim, I think. I once gave a series of shiurim many years ago called By Way of Introduction, which is just introductions of different interesting Sfarim. So I was really excited by that series. I loved it. I thought it was like one of my best, you know, series of shiurim ever. And then I was so excited. I told Rav Schechter about it. I'm like, I'm giving a series of introductions. He's like, but like, what about the Sefer? He's like, how can you just learn introductions to Sfarim? He was not excited by it. But whatever, I was excited. So that's why the second half of the show, we're actually going to learn something that Debre Tzina Rav speaks about. But, or a couple of things. But and you'll see a lot of the personality comes through in his tshuvas also. So in his introduction to Be'er Moshe, he describes how he wanted to publish the Sefer earlier, but he was consumed with dealing with his son's illness and grief over his son's death. Nebuch, he had a son and a daughter before the Holocaust. His daughter was killed in the Holocaust, I think, or maybe right before she died. And his son survived, but then was very ill later on and predeceased him. And he described how his son was Mekabel Yisurin Ba'ava and was a tremendous tzaddik. And he said that he had this is also again a Hungarian thing. He said he had the Sefer Noam Elimelech always under his son's pillow. Anyone hear that one? Yeah. Heard the right one? Oh, from Tevin Halacha, they put it on Noam Elimelech in, I think, in Shari Chesed. They offer for a woman going into labor, here's a Noam Elimelech to put under her pillow. Like, this is a thing that they do. They put a Sefer Noam Elimelech. The only, I once asked Rav Schechter about it, and he said that was Rav Schechter's story with the Chazon Ish. You know the Rav Schechter's story with the Chazon Ish? Rav Schechter used to always quote, still always quotes the Chazon Ish. But sometimes, even on like we're learning brachos, and he's quoting Chazon Ish's on Taharos. Like the Chazon Ish's on Taharos, he like knows like. So we asked him once. I didn't ask him. Rabbi Yaakov Haber told me he asked him once, "What's with you and the Chazon Ish on Taharos?" And Rav Schechter said, "Well, it was my Girsa D'Yankasa. That's what I learned when I was young." So he said, "Why did you learn Chazon Ish on Taharos when you were young?" He said, "Because when I was living in Philadelphia, when I was a little boy in Philadelphia, my father was the rabbi. You're from Philly." Yeah, so you know, do you daven at the shul that Rav Schechter grew up in? They just did a whole video where he went. No,
I live in Long Island, so I don't think.
No, it wasn't Lord Marion. No, this is like downtown Philly. So when he was growing up in Philadelphia, he said his father was the rabbi, and his father wasn't. A lot of these old time rabbis didn't have a million svarim. That wasn't the way they operated. They had a shas, they had a shulchan aruch. And they knew where to look things up. They didn't need, in order to look up Shailin Shiluach HaKein, they didn't need a sefer called Shiluach HaKein Kil Chasam. You know, like they knew where to look in Shulchan Aruch. They knew where to look in Shas. That was the way they operated. There was a Tanakh, a Shas, and a Shulchan Aruch. So Shabbat said that's what he had in his house growing up. And then one day, so he said, I didn't have much reading material other than, you know, Shas and Shulchan Aruch. So he said one day there was a guy in his father's shul whose daughter was very, very ill. And someone told this guy, didn't you grow up in the same town as the Chazanish, as Rav Mishaya Karelitz? So he said, yeah, well, what happened to him? What happened to Rav Mishaya? He said, well, he's the Gadol Dor and he lives in Israel now. You should really send him a letter. So the guy said, okay. So he sent a letter. My daughter's very sick. This fellow in Rav Shachter Senior's shul sent a letter to the Chazanish. My daughter's very sick. Please daven for her. He got back in the mail. Chazanish sent him a copy of his Sefer on Taharos. And he said, put this under your daughter's pillow, and I'm going to daven for her. It was inscribed with something. And Chazanish told him to put it under the daughter's pillow. He said, by the time he got it back in the mail, the daughter was dead already, so it wasn't Shaykh. But now that the guy had this Chazanish, it wasn't a happy ending, I'm sorry. But the Chazanish, but it is kind of a happy ending, because the guy had this Chazanish on Taharos. So he's like, what am I going to do the Chazanish and Taurus? I don't even know which way to hold the Chazanish and Taurus. Like, he's a total Amaris. He doesn't know anything. So he went to the local rabbi and he said, you have any use for this? So Rabbi Shechter Sr., Rabbi Mel Shechter said, sure, I'll take it. So Rabbi Shechter said, it was the only sefer we had around our house. So I used to read the Chazanish and Taurus. So that's what he, that Rabbi Shechter moved out of Philadelphia when he was not yet bar mitzvah, by the way. So, but the Chazanish and Taurus, that was his nighttime reading. That was his leisure reading. So that's how he became a Baki in Chazanish on Taharos. Not yet bar mitzvah. I could tell you what it said in Sports Illustrated in 1988, but I can't tell you what it said in Chazanish on Taharos. Anyway, so how did I get that? Oh, no, Melech under the pillow. So I guess it wasn't only Hungarian thing. Chazanish said to put Chazanish under the pillow. But he said one day, in his son's final illness, he couldn't find the sefer to put under his son's pillow, and that day he died, and poof, it was Noam Elimelech's yard site. Again, the whole statement is like a very, you know, Hungarian way of thinking. The whole thing. He expresses in his introduction, he has great pride in his kehila because they're all Hungarian. And enon utzrichim lilmot Torah v'derech Hashem migdolim yotzei medinas acheros. We don't need to be influenced by people gedolim from other segments of Klal Yisrael. We have our way, and this is the best way to go about things. And it would create a hashkafic divide if we had people from other kehilos. And he for some reason, in the introduction to Ber Moshe, he decides to dedicate a few paragraphs to bash the United Nations and to talk about how terrible the United Nations is and why people shouldn't put any trust in the United Nations. It's fascinating. I don't know what was going on at that time that made him say that, but he says, "Lo anu tuliyim b'da'atam, elahem tuliyim b'ma'aseinu atovim." We aren't subjects of the United Nations and their decisions. What they decide depends on our Torah and mitzvos. Klapei Hashem v'toraso. Ha-U-N, he says, "Lo ha-U-N machria, it's not the UN that decides what goes on. Our lives in the Beis Medrash, our Shmir Torah Mitzvos, decides what will go on in the UN. Because the hearts of kings and officers is in the hands of God. And that's certainly something that that we believe. You know, we asked Rav Shechter once, you know, whether it's to be nervous if one person wins an election or another person wins an election for the presidential election. He said, nothing to be nervous. He said, your status is to vote for the right person, but once they're voted into office, they lose their Bechir Chafshis anyway. Meaning, they it's Lev Malach and Biad Hashem. They don't have the ability to choose one way or the other. The status is, you have to vote whoever you think is the best candidate, but once they're in office, Lev Malach and Biad Hashem. Okay, so now, is it, yeah, we're a half hour in? Oh, more than a half hour. Okay, so now let's get to actual Torah that he says. Okay, so let's get to some of the discussions that he has. Some of the, maybe we'll highlight two or three interesting tshuvas that the Be'er Moshe has. So one interesting tshuva that he has is he discusses, and this was, it was a sign of the times that he was dealing with, he discusses whether a person has to wear a yarmulke to work. This was a huge issue in like the 1950s, 60s in America, whether you're going to wear, and beyond, whether you're going to wear a yarmulke to work. Nowadays, it's certainly if you work in the New York tri-state area, it's like there's kimat no issue. As recently as like the 1980s or 90s, Rabbi Willick told me that that he had a Talmud that was a brilliant Talmud, and he graduated a top law school, so he decided to play a game. He was going to be interviewed by 10 law firms, and he went to 5 interviews wearing a yarmulke and 5 interviews not wearing a yarmulke. The 5 that he went not wearing a yarmulke to, he was offered 5 jobs. He was offered a job at every one. The 5 that he went wearing a yarmulke to, he was offered 1 job. So as much as, you know, you think, like, we're past that and we're beyond that, we hope that we're past that, but it's not so clear that we are. But certainly in the early days, this was a major, major issue. In the middle part of the 20th century, this was a major issue. To wear a yarmulke in the workplace was not possible. In fact, a lot of the law firms in those days wouldn't hire from Jews. There was a whole... Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this in one of his books, how there was a whole set of law firms that arose because they were doing the kinds of work that the WASPy white shoe law firms weren't interested in, and so it was like a bunch of brilliant Jewish kids who graduated law school in the 1950s that started these firms, and then, you know, Kay Scholer and all these, you know, big firms were born out of that. But anyway, so my wife's uncle graduated law school, I don't know when, but he was a Talmud of the Rav, maybe in the late 50s, maybe in 1960 or so. He was a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, and none of these firms were hiring from people. So Rav Soloveitchik somehow knew one of the partners in the firm, and Rav Soloveitchik said, "I have 2 Talmidim that are going to be the best lawyers you ever had. I'm telling you, you should hire them." And largely on Rav Soloveitchik's word, they did hire him. And Rav Soloveitchik told him not to wear a yarmulke in the office. That it would be that it's like poking the bear. That you don't want to do that. Once, you know, he brought in the Reichman account into the firm, then he was he started the Mincha Minyan in his office and the yarmulke, you know, and he started wearing the yarmulke. But before bringing in the Reichman account, which is also a fascinating story, but not for now, how he brought in that account. You've seen the book about Paul Reichman. He was like the richest guy for very, very rich Jew did a lot of good. The art school just put out a biography of that, and they interviewed my wife's uncle for it. He's quoted him there a few times. So anyway, so the Debrecen Rav has a tshuva about this, about wearing a yarmulke in the workplace. So it happens to be Rav Moshe also has a tshuva about this, and you'll find this very often. Rav Moshe, not being Rav Moshe Stern, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about every major topic that came up in the second half of the 20th century. Right? He was the go-to person. In fact, there's like a whole cottage industry of other poskim who seems like their entire job was to disagree with Rav Moshe or to assess whether they agree or disagree with Rav Moshe. Meaning, it was obvious that Rav Moshe was going to have a say, and then anybody else gets to chime in. And so there's like this Rav Moshe in the center of the circle, and then you have like all these people around the circle that wrote tshuvas, like the Be'er Moshe and the Minchas Yitzchak, and the, you know, all these other tshuvas that were written around that time, the Mishnah Lachos and others. So Debrecen Rav wrote a tshuva about this, but Rav Moshe had already written a tshuva about this. Rav Moshe in Or Chaim in Chelik Dalit Simen Beis is matir. He says that you're allowed to go to work without a yarmulke, and he says why? What would be the svara? What would be the svara to go to work without a yarmulke?
Parnasa.
How big? Whenever you're discussing any judgment call, does, you know, what gives? You always have to figure out how serious a halacha this is, right? What? Shalom Bayit. Okay, but 1 second. Before we get there, how serious a halacha is this? Meaning yarmulke. How important is it? So there are 3 options, right? It's the Oraisa, it's the Rabbanan, or it's Minhag. And depending on what you hold about that, will give it different weight when it's going up against your Parnasa, when it's going up against your Shalom Bayit, let's say, when it's going up against other things. So Rav Moshe writes that Hanir Lanias Daiti, dimutter, that it's mutter to go with the yarmulke. The ladina begemaru l'rov hashitos havigilei rosh aflelech bashuk rak midas chasidus. He says most opinions hold wearing a yarmulke is a midas chasidus. And he says, "Aval kazusha kolad mitzarech this night midas chasidus." It's the kind of midas chasidus that you have to do. It's not like a kind of midas chasidus that's like an outlandish chumrah that you don't have to do. It's kind of midas chasidus that all of Klal Yisrael accepted, and that of course you have to do. But you should realize that the level of obligation is not the oraisa, it's not the rabbanan. It's a level called midas chasidus. And then he says, and maybe even to be maskir shem shemayim, that's a bigger chiddush. Maybe even to say shem Hashem begilei arosh, according to the Chumash Hadeshen, is not an isser mefurash, is not such an obvious, explicit isser, which is also a great chiddush. Then Rav Moshe says, but what about the Taz? There is a Taz that writes that it's not a midas chasidus, that it's a daraisa. Whoa, daraisa? How could it be a daraisa? Think about daraisas. You need to have a pasuk if it's a daraisa. Where is the pasuk? Where is the pasuk that says you have to wear a yarmulke? So there's no pasuk that says you have to wear a yarmulke. How could the Taz say it's a daraisa? By the way, Rav Moshe's very first tshuva, in all of Igros Moshe, Moshe finds his very first tshuva is about the size of a yarmulke. This is why one of the criticisms that the Satmar Chassidim had in Rav Moshe is that your first tshuva in the whole sefer has to be that you're allowed to wear a small yarmulke. Meaning that was the tshuva. He said that Rav Moshe, if you ever saw a picture of him, wore a gigantic yarmulke. But his first tshuva is that it's kosher to wear a small yarmulke as long as someone looking at you would say, "Oh yeah, the person has something on their head." Meaning if it's so tiny that people can't even see it, then it wouldn't be kosher. That might depend on how short you are, I don't know, or how bald you are. Like Naftali Bennett, it's obvious, right? You know, but even though it's teeny tiny, someone would have to be able to look at you and say, "Yeah, that person is wearing a yarmulke." That's what Ramosha's basic tshuva is. But in Ramosha writes that he quotes the Taz. The Taz says that it's din d'oraisa. Why? Because he says it's an isra called chukas hagayim, chukas ha'akum. He says it's the derech of Ovdei Kochavim to go begilui arosh, especially when they're going to worship in their churches. They take off their hats. You know, it used to be that the goyim would always wear hats in the street, right? They say that President Kennedy was responsible for people not wearing hats anymore. I don't know if that's true or not true, but I suspect it's not. But they say that at his inauguration, he wanted to show how young and vibrant he was, because that's what, you know, part of what he ran on. The inauguration is always in January in Washington, which is, you know, the right. East Coast, it's freezing cold always. So he didn't wear a hat. He didn't wear a hat at his inauguration to show that he could, you know, like the third grader that never needs a coat, you know, like he was going to show it. So at that point, people stopped, and also he wanted to be more casual and whatever, relatable. But at that point, people stopped wearing hats. But it used to be that the guy would always wear hats in the streets, and when they come into church, they take off their hat. And they would only worship the Gilei Arosh. So the Taz says, when we are Megala Rosh, when we uncover our heads, we're following the Chukos Hagayim, and that's an Isra Daraisa. So says Rav Moshe, that no longer applies. Because it's no longer the Derech of Ovdei Kochavim to go Bekisa Arosh, that they would even be Megala. Meaning they don't wear hats in the street anyway. And even if they did, it has nothing to do with worshipping, not worshipping, or any religious reasons. You know when non-Jews wear hats nowadays, says Rav Moshe? When it's cold. And you know when they don't wear hats? When it's hot. You know, like that's it. Or if it's sunny, they'll put on a baseball cap. A hat is not a symbol of anything anymore. And therefore, Moshe thought that we don't have to pass like this Taz, because even the Taz would agree that it's not a daraisa, it's a mitzvah chasidus, and therefore you're allowed to go without a yarmulke. Comes along the Debre Tzina Rav, and he says, I disagree. He doesn't quote Rav Moshe, but he says he disagrees. He disagrees as follows. He says, first, he starts out every tshuva nishalti, I was asked, and then heshavti. And here's my brief answer, and then he goes through details. So he says nishalti, I was asked. Someone was offered a job, and they're not going to be allowed to wear a yarmulke if they take that job. Heshavti al pi halacha yeshmakom lahatir, aval atzasi shebevade lo lekabel mishrazu. He says probably al pi halacha there's room to be mekil, but my advice is do not accept such a job. Kigile Rosh Margila La'adam Lekalus Rosh Lef Kevus. You're going to see that you're going to change if you don't wear a yarmulke. That you're going to start acting, behaving in a way of Kalus Rosh, a way of Hefkerus. It's going to have a negative impact on the way that you behave if you don't wear a yarmulke. Again, it's not easy for a Rav to tell somebody who's unemployed not to take a job offer. It's not easy. But Deborah Sina Rav was a very, very principled person, and he advised the person, don't take the job. And then he starts giving makoros. There's a Gemara in Kiddush and Daf Lamed Aleph. Rav Huna Ben Yehoshua loved a maski dalar amos be gilei rosh. Rav Huna Ben Yehoshua didn't walk four amos with gilei rosh. Right? That's why people sometimes are very makbid. They're not going to go more than a few steps with gilei rosh. If they drop the yarmulke, can you get me my yarmulke? Right? They don't want to go even more than a few steps. Shabbos Daf Kuf Yuches and Beis. That one of the Amoraim said, Tasili delos agina dalar amos be gilei rosh. Tasili means I deserve a lot of credit. I deserve my olam haba. I'm earning my keep because I don't go dalar amos. Begile Arosh. So some of the Mefarshim understand that Tasili is always a Midas Chasidus, that it's not Ikra Din, but Deborah Sina Rav brings many Makoros that maybe it is Me Ikra Din. And then he says, and I have a Kabbalah from the Elta Zeda. The Elta Zeda again, the Chasam Sofer. He married, he married a great-granddaughter of the Chasam Sofer. His wife was a great-granddaughter of the Chasam Sofer. So he says, I have a Kabbalah from the Elta Zeda. Here's the Kabbalah. Ha-holich b'gili ha-rosh, eino meshukatz l'fisho holich b'gili ha-rosh. Someone who goes without a yarmulke is not a lowlife just because he's going without a yarmulke. El m'meshu meshukatz holich b'gili ha-rosh. It's because he's a lowlife that he goes without a yarmulke. So he says, that was the nusach yas of the Chasam Sofer. It's not that going without a yarmulke makes him a lowlife, it's because he's already a lowlife, he goes without a yarmulke. So he says that as far as minhag hagayim, he says it's absolutely minhag hagayim. The Taz writes in Simun Ches that since the Ovdei Avodah Zarah made a chok la'avodah zarah, they made a rule for Avodah Zarah, leilich davka b'gil rosh ulechabit Avodah Zarah, because that's how they worship the Avodah Zarah, so it's asur lanu min hadin. And he says, and a lot of times, something that's done initially for an Avodah Zarah reason. This is an interesting point that it reflects on a lot of things in Halacha. Let's say the Goyim start doing something for an Avodah Zarah reason. And then they just keep doing it, even long after they forget that Avodah Zarah reason. They just keep doing it. So is that still Aser? So that's still Chukas Akum. That's still going to be Aser. He says, you know, what if it's something that we were doing first? Meaning we did it for other reasons. And then they started doing it for an Avodah Zarah reason. So Deborah Sina Rav says, I think it's still problematic. Which is a big chiddush. That's a major machlokas.
Not like kneeling during davening, which we used to do, and we stopped doing
it. Ah, okay. The bigger example I could think of is machlokas haposkim about trees in shul on Shavuos. Right? Notice we always put flowers in shul. We don't put trees in shul on Shavuos. Why not trees? Because the Gra writes that this was a chukas ha'akum, that they used to have trees in their worship. So we don't want to, it's still, they still have Christmas trees, which are a reflection of something, but, you know, no one really knows. But if it's something that they, even though they've long forgotten why they do it, and we did it first, perhaps, to remember our Sinai, perhaps, but nevertheless, he says it still takes on such a status. It's a major question about, like, that I never had really answered properly about why yoga is mutter. Right? Meaning yoga, all the poses and everything, they're all, what do you think a sun salutation is? Right? It's you know, all these things, where all these exercises, these Far East exercises, they're all based on Avodah Zarah. Happens to be, it's super healthy and really great for your balance and for your, you know, muscle tone and things like that. But they were, it all started with Avodah Zarah. So can you kasher it? Can you, you know, not say namaste or not, you know, like do different things that whatever, you know, and use different terminology? It's a major question. So Deborah Sina Rav thinks that anything that they did for Avodah Zarah, even though they're not doing for Avodah Zarah anymore, so now they go Begilei HaRosh because President Kennedy went Begilei HaRosh. But it used to be that they would go Begilei HaRosh for Avodah Zarah, so that's still the Chukas HaGoyim, he suggests. And then he says a story. And the story sort of reveals a lot of what I was saying before in terms of where he's coming from. His story is, and it's best in its original Hebrew, he says, Umeira ni alai shamayim va'aretz. As God is my witness, I guess is the best, you know, the best translation. Shepam hayu lefanai din Torah ish v'ishto me'akasa mischadshim. One time I had a din Torah, a man and his wife, they were getting divorced. from the Kas HaMischadshim. What does that mean? Modern Orthodox. Avol Shomri Shabbos V'Taras HaMishpacha. They were Shomer Shabbos. They were Shomer Taras Hamishpacha. Aval Belavachi. But other than that, Chayim Kechayi Echum Mnei Artzos Abristam. They were like regular Americans. Other than Shmir Shabbos and Taras Hamishpacha. Ukimat Mi Bechutz Einenu Nikur Shuhu Yehudi Vihi Yehudis. And you couldn't even the way they dressed. You couldn't tell that he was a Jew. She was a Jew. Ki Partzufeim Bekdei Rosh Vyad Regel. From the Kepala to the Fitzula, they were right. They were dressed. Like a they played that song in Kaylee for a month straight on the so it's in my head. From the Kepler to the Vitzel, they were absolutely looked like regular me Bnei America, which is like a dirty word for him. Ube emtzum el chamtam shahorik zeh al zu vizu al zeh gofris v'melach. And as they were fighting and throwing things at each other and accusations, sima dvareha shel aratzel levayshu kol kach lefanai. She said, you know, I don't want to really embarrass him this much in front of the Beis Din, but since he said not nice things to me, I'm going to tell you something that is disgusting that he used to do. And what did she say? Shehu achar achilas erev, kishaposhe teiton angli, likrot. And after dinner, he would take out his newspaper, his English newspaper, v'yoshev mekisei rachvas yadayim, and he sat in his recliner, v'shenu hum... He would take his yarmulke off and read Begilei Rosh. So says Rabbi Sina Rav, this woman thought she was hurling the worst accusation against him. Like, this is going to be something that's going to make the Beis Din lose all respect for him. And what did she say? That when he'd read the newspaper, he'd take off his yarmulke. He said, these are people that they observe Shabbos and Taras HaMishpacha, and that's it. There's nothing about them that smells of Judaism. And the one thing that she singles out that must be his worst midah, and that everyone is that she understood is the worst thing, and that he was humiliated when she shared, was that he takes off his yarmulke when he reads the newspaper at night, sitting in his chair. What do I see from there, says Deborah Tzinarov, that it's become part of our psyche. It's become part of how we define what being a religious Jew means. It's not, it rises above the level of just minag, darabanan, daraisa, midas chasidus, this, that. It's not about that anymore. If you meet a person who's wearing a yarmulke, what's your immediate assumption? He's a Jew. He's a frum Jew. And you meet someone who's not wearing a yarmulke, I don't know if he's Jewish or not, but he's not a frum Jew. Meaning that's how we define what a Shomer Torah mitzvah is by the yarmulke. And he says, L'chein b'shum ofen, eineni maskimu meni lo yetzei hora lahatir. I cannot agree, I cannot give a psak to be matir, to accept a job where you're not going to wear a yarmulke. Shavua achar shavua, chodesh achar chodesh, begilei arosh, week after week, and month after month. He says, it's gonna just lead a person down a road where he's gonna end up in a very bad place. So he says, I know you need it for your parnasa, I cannot approve of this. So now what's the obvious question? What's the next question? Okay, so that was the psak, right? So what happened to the guy? Right? And so a lot of times you read a tshuva and you're like, right, so what happened? You know, like, but the tshuva doesn't tell you what happened next. It just like tells you what the shaila was, what the answer was, and like you're dying to know what happened. Deborah Sina Rav publishes tshuvas years later. So he was able to go back and to put in a little P.S. at the end of the tshuva. So he puts a little P.S. at the end of the tshuva. Ushmua tova tichenetzem. He says, and I'll tell you good news that gave me a lot of chizik. Tziltzel li ha-shoel. He rang me, he gave me a phone call. That after he received my tshuva, he turned down the job. He says, lo kibel misrazu ki kol dvarai nichnasu l'ramrachei varav ushagidav. He was so shaken by my tshuva. And Vigam Tirgame Dvarai Lishto, and he translated it for his wife. And she then said, I don't want you to take the job, that it shouldn't cause him any. And he says, Va'achar Zman Kotzer, Kibel Mitzra Acheres Harbe Yoser Tova Merishon. And after a short amount of time, he got a much better job offer that allowed him to wear a yarmulke, and he lived happily ever after. Now, does that mean that the tshuva would have been wrong if he didn't live happily ever after, if he remained unemployed and on food stamps? For this? No, but he says, you know, it's a nice piece of the story. So that's one particular psak of the Deborah Tzina Rav that I think sort of highlights the Deborah Tzina Rav. Another psak of the Deborah Tzina Rav, we have time for one more. Another psak of Deborah Tzina Rav that I think is interesting is Deborah Tzina Rav, and also highlights something unique about the Deborah Tzina Rav, is I didn't mention before, he had relationships with a lot of the Hasidic rebbes, a lot of the Gedolei Torah. He was very close to the Rav Aaron Cutler. He was very close to the Satmar Rebbe, very close to the Satmar Rebbe. He held the Satmar Rebbe in very high regard. And he was even close with the Lubavitch Rebbe, which is not a pasha thing to be close with both the Satmar Rebbe and the Lubavitch Rebbe. I don't know if you know the history, but you know, they didn't get along. So there was issues there, right? So and it wasn't easy. The Lubavitch Rebbe wasn't easy to be close to because if you were a great rabbi, because most great rabbis will meet people at weddings, you know, will meet other great rabbis at weddings, at conventions, at you know things like that. Lubavitch Rebbe never went anywhere, right? You know about the Lubavitch Rebbe? He stayed at 770, and the only place he ever went, what's the one place he ever went? To the Ayel, right? To his father-in-law's Ayel. That's the only place he never went anywhere. You wanted to speak with him. First of all, you were on his schedule. Like, heads of state would come, senators and presidents would come at 3 a.m., because that's when he was willing to meet with you. And you had a yechidus with him, and it was worth it for people. They would come. But Deborah Senior went. He went to 770 to meet with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked him to write a tshuva that Mashiach should come, a psak halacha on Mashiach that he has to come already in that that meeting. Meaning, the Lubavitcher Rebbe held that he had such a koach psak that the Deborah Senior was so capable of issuing a psak that maybe if he paskins that Mashiach has to come, then Mashiach will come. So that was in the meeting with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There were other things that were interesting about the meeting with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe gave him a bracha that when Mashiach comes, he should be appointed to the Sanhedrin. It happens to be the Satmar Rebbe is the one that told him to start supervising kashrus. The kashrus still exists, the Debrecina kashrus. He was the one, the original hashkacha on Klein's ice cream. You heard of Klein's ice cream? The Chalav Yisrael ice cream you get when you go to Beirut in the Woodridge. So it's Klein's ice cream. Klein's ice cream, at the beginning, didn't have much money. They couldn't really pay for the Ashkacha. So they paid him in ice cream. So like all the kids from the neighborhood, whenever they'd walk by, his wife would be like, "Here, I have a treat for you." She'd like give them ice cream. He's had freezers full of Klein's ice cream because they didn't have any money, but they had freezers full of Klein's ice cream. But another interesting tshuva that he wrote about, because I'm thinking about the relationship with the Satmar Rebbe, was about whether you're allowed to use paper or plastic cups for Kiddush and for Netilas Yadayim and the like. What does that have to do with the Satmar Rebbe? So here's what it has to do with the Satmar Rebbe. Rav Moshe, this is again another disagreement with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe held that you're not allowed, at least the Chachila, it's really not a good idea to use paper or plastic cups for Kiddush. Why? So Rav Moshe had a Chiddush. Rav Moshe held that the Gemara says that you're supposed to, that a kosher bracha has to be chai. And what does chai mean? So it's a machlokes rishon whether it means the wine, or whether it's a reference to the wine or the kos, but we paskin that the kos has to be shalim, that the kos can't be broken, it can't be tilted over, it has to be a kos shalim. So Rav Moshe understood that worse than a silver becher that's a little dented is a cheap piece of plastic that you throw out after 1 year. That's less shalim. That takes away its shame kli. The other, that takes away its shleimus. The other argument is that it doesn't have anything that's chad pa'ami, that you only use once, doesn't have a shame kli at all. That argument was not made by Rav Moshe, it was made by a sefer called Mishnas Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Lipschitz. Rav Yaakov Lipschitz was also a follower of the Satmar Rebbe, and Rav Yaakov Lipschitz said, I brought my rayas to the Satmar Rebbe, and he approved of my rayas that you're not allowed to use a plastic cup. Says the Deborah Tzina Rav, Lo shamati mitalmidei Rabbeinu Rabin shel kol b'nei Agolda admor misatmar shlita sheyishom menu lesser kiddush l'ntis tzedai mikos keilu. I never heard from any of the other talmidim in the Satmar Rebbe that he had a problem with it. He says v'gam sha'alti mirabanim talmidei chamuv hakam shlita sheyodim das Rabbeinu shlita. And I asked some of his greatest talmidim, people who know every shita he has, b'chol inyanim anogim elachayim yom yomayim v'lo shamu me'ola mipekotcho sheymar al adavar. They never heard him have a problem with this. The Mishnas Yaakov says so. I wouldn't question him. He says, I'll tell you what happened. Yeah, Mishnas Yaakov had a chiddush that paper cups are going to be usher to use, and he came up with this raya from Mishnah and Kalin about choslos. We don't have time to get into the raya right now, but he came up with this great raya, and he was so excited. When you have a chiddush, what do you want to do? You want to go and you want to share it with somebody, right? You ever have a chiddush in learning? You should have this experience. You have a chiddush. Rav Aaron Kahn told us that he was once in the Y.U. Beis Medrash when he was a bachur, and Rav Yeruchim Gurella came running in and grabbed him by the lapels and says, "Aaron, listen to this chiddush." You know, like he was bursting at the seams with a chiddush that he wanted to share with somebody. So he said, I could see what happened. The Mishnas Yaakov had this chiddush, and he ran into the Sabra Rebbe, and he was so excited, and he said this chiddush, and the Sabra Rebbe smiled and nodded. So the Mishnas Yaakov said, okay, so that means he agrees. But obviously what the Sabra Rebbe was smiling and nodding about was that he was so happy that his Talmud had such a chiddush, and that his Talmud was so excited about learning. But of course he doesn't agree la halacha. So the Debrecen Rav says, if the Sabra Rebbe agreed la halacha, I would have no choice but to agree with the Sabra Rebbe because he's so great. But I disagree. I think that paper cups and plastic cups are perfectly fine to use for kiddush. And he rejects each of the rayas in the other direction. Meaning all the poskim that bring rayas in the other direction, the rayas from the Mishnayos and Kalim and the rayas from Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe is a very big chiddush. Rav Moshe Feinstein is a very big chiddush that it loses, meaning there's a difference between a broken cup that's not what it's meant to be versus a kli that's just cheap, right? There's no like a price minimum for a kli.
So what about the idea of using two cups?
Yes. Okay. The idea of using two cups, I don't know of any sefer that suggests it, although I once got a Hanukkah present from my first cousin who I just saw last week in Hask. My first cousin, Alyssa and Avi Sachs, one Chanukah, we had a big family Chanukah party, they got me a Chanukah present, a big book of Gedolim pictures. Okay, so I was flipping through the book of Gedolim pictures, and had little captions in each picture, and Rav Ezrachi was holding two plastic cups in one of the pictures, and the caption said that there was a bris in the mirror or something, and they forgot the becher, they forgot the kiddush cup. And it used like some exaggerated lashon, and said like pandemonium broke loose or something like that, and no one knew what to do. And Rav Scheinberg was there, and Rav Scheinberg said, just use two plastic cups. And that's what he did. So that's my only maramakom for using two plastic cups. It's a picture book that I got from my cousin, but I don't know of any sefer that says anything about the two plastic cups. I don't know, I'm not sure where that comes from. Okay, everyone have a wonderful evening. Tomorrow we'll do someone else. I don't know who. Okay.